The would-be 17th century reformer González de Sayorigo explained that money was not true wealth, and that Spain's future was being dissipated on thin air, on papers, contracts, censos, loans, and letters of exchange, on cash and silver and gold, instead of being expended on things that yield profits and attract riches from outside to augment the riches within. Foreign observers said much the same thing. One historian concluded that for two centuries, Spain squandered its wealth and manpower. Perhaps, but for a limited comparison with the latter-day United States, this description begs the issue. Nothing even resembling gross domestic product or gross national product data is available for 16th and 17th century Spain. But if it were, what might it show? After gold and silver began flooding Spain, agriculture and what industry there was withered. Ambitious persons decamped for the Madrid of organized religion, the Habsburg court, and the treasure port of Seville. Through 1620 or so, these three were the flourishing economic sectors. As such, they must have produced a significant GDP. Booming Seville, with a population of 150,000, became Europe's third city after Paris and Naples. And in 1585, the Spanish merchant fleet, by one count, rivaled the Dutch, doubled the German, Hanseatic, and trebled the English and French. Madrid, two-thirds the size of Seville, thronged with bureaucrats, court parasites, and luxury purveyors. We shall hear about the foreign financial services vendors there momentarily. No small part of Madrid's royal and church wealth came from bullion. The crown took one-fifth of the gold and silver, and other fees, duties, and thinly disguised extortions were legion. The church and religious houses like the Jesuits, largely untaxed, drew great returns from Spanish America. By the 18th century, the Jesuits, with their lands and mines, were reckoned to be the biggest slaveholders in South America. The large, foreign-dominated mercantile and financial communities in Madrid and Seville gorged on legitimate trade, bullion smuggling, tax collecting on behalf of the government, silver brokerage, insurance arrangements, bills of exchange, and investments in various forms of debt instruments. The Castilian Parliament, furious at the property rights and preferences accorded foreign financiers, protested in 1548 that a consequence of Your Majesty's loans in Germany and Italy is that a great number of foreigners have come here. They are not satisfied just with their profits from banking, nor with obtaining property, bishoprics, and estates, but are buying up all the wool, silk, leather, and other goods. Of the 29 million ducats Charles V borrowed from bankers, 21.9 million came from Genoese and Germans. Historians and economists are only beginning to piece together the volumes and profits involved. Many of the nobility or lesser hidalgo class, along with churchmen and the various religious orders, were on the rentier side, deriving much of their income from offices purchased or awarded, investments in the colonies, and debt instruments called juros. The latter were cherished linchpins of a highly elaborate credit system, a system which no doubt received much of its impetus from the exigencies of the crown's finances. Anyone with money to spare, a noble, a merchant, or a wealthy peasant, or institutions like convents, could lend it to private persons, or municipal corporations, or else to the crown, at a guaranteed 5, 7, or 10%. Such opportunities, indirectly enabled by bullion, shrank the pool of capital available for bolder ventures. Like debt in the U.S. GDP of the early 2000s, juros and other forms of indebtedness likely added up to a disconcerting share of the Spanish GDP circa 1600.